Things off my list so that I'm not stressed.
Thank you. On the record, Mr. Plank, further questions?
Thank you, Commissioner Clark. I just have one more question. And that is, if there were to be a more thorough cost-benefit analysis, as you mentioned, would be useful, do you believe that that process should be transparent, inclusive of all parties, and one that allows for time to include information that might maybe obtained from further studies that the company has planned, including the load study they've mentioned they're going to do later?
Yes.
Thank you. That's all.
Ms. Roberts.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad you made it after what sounds like difficult travels yesterday.
It was. Thank you.
Are you familiar with the company's testimony that it is only seeking to recover a portion of fixed costs from net metering customers at this time?
Yes.
And that position is based on principles of gradualism?
Yes.
Okay. So if this fee is approved by the commission, the net metering facilities charge, do you think it is likely to increase over time?
Well, that'll depend on a host of factors related to whether the distribution system costs in particular increase over time, and also potentially the number of net metering customers.
Okay. Utility customers are generally familiar with the concept that any fees imposed, such as fixed customer charges or rates, those things generally increase over time, correct?
As a general matter, they will.
Okay. Do you think the chance that this fee might increase over time would be relevant to a customer's consideration about the lifetime costs of the fee in their decision to install solar?
It could potentially, you know, I want to note that it is paid over time. It's a relatively small amount, so it's hard to say when you're facing an investment in the thousands of dollars whether a fee per month that may increase in cents per month level would have any appreciable impact on their investment decision.
Okay. So while we're on this topic, I'd like to turn to page 10 of your rebuttal testimony.
I'm there, line numbers.
All right, actually that is the wrong page. Let's start with line 195.
Okay.
Which is page 11.
Page 11 on mine. Thank you.
Just let me know when you're there.
I'm there.
Okay. Yeah. Now, in this, beginning with this question, you're critiquing Sierra Club witness Dr. Mulvaney's analysis regarding the lifetime investment costs for a net metering facility, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Mulvaney was describing how higher fixed charges would affect the payback period for installing solar on your rooftop, correct?
As I understood his testimony, yes.
Okay. As a general matter, if a utility company recovers more of its fixed costs through fixed charges, it will recover less of that cost of its revenue requirement through the rates, correct?
Well, a fixed cost charge is a rate. Do you mean volumetric rates?
Thank you, yes, volumetric rates.
Well, by definition, given a certain revenue requirement, if the fixed cost charges increase, then the volumetric rates would have to decrease commensurately in order to keep that revenue neutral.
Okay, thank you. And would you agree that if volumetric rates are lower, then the investment payback period for installing a rooftop system becomes longer?
No, I don't. I'm not sure I agree with that, no.
If you're going to make a 10, if a customer is going to make a $10,000 investment and it's doing so in part because it believes that it will reduce the amount of volumetric rate that it's paying to the utility, might the customer evaluate the time period over which that investment would be paid off?
Well, I think the customer would make that evaluation regardless of the rate structure.
Right, but the rate structure would be relevant to that customer's analysis.
Potentially, yes.
So, will you agree with me for the sake of argument that if rates are lower, the period of time over which it would take to pay back an investment might be longer?
If the entirety of the rates the customer pays are lower, is that what you're saying?
I'm thinking of the volumetric rate specifically. Since the customer can't avoid the fixed charges, only the volumetric rate would be relevant to their decision about how long it would take to pay back their investment.
Well, as I said, I would evaluate the entire rate structure if I were in that position making an investment.
So you might evaluate whether there's an extra fixed charge for installing solar in your house?
I would consider it, yes.
And if you thought that extra fixed charge might go up over time, might that be an extra disincentive for installing solar?
All else equal, it may provide an increased disincentive.
Okay, thank you.
And let me add that typically all else is never equal.
Very true. We like to make that simplifying assumption, don't we? With respect to the potential that the net metering facilities charge could increase over time, either due to inflation or changing numbers of net metering customers or the company deciding to seek recovery for different categories of fixed costs, at what point would that increasing rate go outside your zone of reasonableness?
The zone of reasonableness, again, is a subjective measure, but to the extent that the rates were too high to be just and reasonable or to reflect the principle of cost causation, that's where it would go outside of my zone of reasonableness.
Okay. So your zone of reasonableness is not doesn't involve any quantitative assessment of the costs and benefits of net metering?
No, I think it does, but it is, again, a subjective assessment, and I'd have to consider the numbers at the time going forward.
Is it likely that once a net metering facilities charge is imposed, it would ever be eliminated from the rate structure?
I think it could be, and again, it would depend on the Commission's determination of the benefits and costs of the net metering program, and in particular, how they affected utility costs as a whole, because those are paid by all customers.
Okay. So at a certain point, the Commission might decide that the fee was no longer within the zone of reasonableness, undertake a cost-benefit analysis, and determine that no fee was justified? Is that possible? No fee.
I suppose anything is possible like that, yes.
Okay, thank you. On page 10 of your rebuttal testimony, and this is actually a continuation of a question that was asked on page 9, beginning on line 154 of your rebuttal testimony, you evaluate whether Dr. Mulvaney provided a proper cost-benefit portrayal of net energy metering. And skipping over on to page 10, you note that his testimony didn't involve consideration of foregone Rocky Mountain Power retail rate revenues, or from the NEM customer perspective, the value of retail energy rate avoidance as a credit. Do you agree that cost-benefit analysis can be done from many different perspectives?
I do.
Okay. And are you familiar with the recent report done for the Nevada Public Utility Commission evaluating net metering in that state?
Familiar, yes. An expert on it, no.
Okay. Have you read the portions of that report where it evaluates the benefits of net metering from using different tests and different perspectives?
I'm aware that's the structure of the report, yes.
Okay. Do you think that that kind of report might be useful to this commission in determining the costs and benefits under SB 208?
Along with other evidence produced by the company and all interveners, it could potentially play a role, yes.
Correct. And that kind of study led by an outside independent party could take into consideration information and perspectives provided by the company and other interveners, correct?
Yes.
Did you hear earlier when Dr. Powell stated in response to Ms. Hayes's question that he thought that any reductions in the distribution peak caused by net metering customers would be reflected in the cost of service study for the residential class?
Yes, I was there.
If reductions in distribution peak that are caused by output from rooftop solar panels are already reflected in the cost of service study for the residential class, does that mean that net metering customers are reducing the revenue requirement for that class?
Could you restate that, because it appeared that your question had the answer embedded within it?
My question did have a premise relating to my previous question, and that premise is, if reductions in distribution peak load are caused by output from rooftop solar panels during the distribution peak period, and that reduced distribution peak is reflected in the cost of service for the residential class. We'll just stop with those two premises. I'm sorry to make this too complicated of a question.
I'm trying, but could you restate that, please?
Okay, because we'll break it down.
Okay.
If net metering customers, their solar panels produce output during the time of distribution peak, and it reduces the overall distribution peak by some percentage, then the distribution peak associated with the residential class would be lower, correct?
All else being equal, yes.
Thank you, yes. And if the distribution peak for the residential class is lower, then the revenue that the company can recover from the residential class as a whole due to distribution costs would also be lower, correct? All else being equal?
Please restate.
Okay.
I did not understand that.
If the distribution peak for the residential class is lower than it would be without net metering customers, then the company can collect less revenue from the residential class associated with distribution system costs, correct?
Without any other adjustment in rates, including potentially a net metering facilities charge or other increases to other rates, the answer is yes.
Okay. So if the amount of revenue that is being collected from residential customers is less due to net metering customers than residential rates, all else being equal, would decrease slightly, correct?
Again, please restate. I did not understand the premise of that.
Okay. If the amount of revenue that the company is collecting from the residential class based on distribution costs goes down, then rates will go down, correct? All else being equal?
I just don't understand the based on distribution costs piece.
The cost of service studies that the utility does for each class look at what overall system costs can be attributed to that class, correct?
That's correct.
And the rates for that class are based on the costs that can be attributed to that class?
That's correct.
Okay. So if one of those costs goes down, all else being equal, the rates for that class would go down, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So if distribution costs attributable to the residential class go down, all else being equal, rates for the residential class would go down.
That's correct.
Okay. So if output from net metering systems reduces distribution costs by any amount, residential rates would go down, correct?
If they were attributable to the net metering and that was traceable back to the residential class, and with the caveat that all else is equal, the answer is yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. No further questions.
Ms. Hayes.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark. Good morning.
Good morning.
Would you accept, subject to check, that for an average net metering customer using 511 kilowatt hours a month, that a $4.65 increase is roughly an 8.3% rate increase? And I can walk you through my math if you want.
Please do that.
All right.
I think I'm going to answer your question the way you want it. But.
Well, so what I did is, and I, for simplicity's sake, I assumed an 11-cent per kilowatt hour energy rate and multiplied it by 511 kilowatt hours to arrive at $56.21, and then divided that, or rather, divided 465 by 5621 to arrive at what percentage 465 is of 5621.
Okay, I think I follow your math, yes.
All right. And the and I got 8.27%. Following that same math, but dividing 4.25 cents by 5621, I got $7.56% as the rate increase with a $4.25 net metering fee. Does that sound correct, subject to check?
Yes.
All right. Do you remember your conversation with Mr. Rossetti while you, Mr. Rossetti, where you talked about the principle of gradualism?
I do.
So is it your position that at $4.25 a month, a 7.6% rate increase complies with gradualism, while an 8.3% increase is just a bridge too far, if you will?
The $4.25 per month is a represents a share of distribution cost recovery that has been deemed acceptable by the commission in light of the fact that gradualism is a worthy rate objective.
Do you mean the division?
I'm sorry.
Thank you. So then you agree that 7.6% increase is gradual, but the difference between 7.6 and 8.3 takes it over the top?
Not necessarily, no. The $425 per month has been deemed acceptable by the division.
I have no more questions.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Mr. Jetta, redirect.
I do have a brief set of redirect questions. Mr. Frenyers, are you familiar with how costs are allocated in Utah to the residential customer class?
I am.
And are those based on circuit loading or transformer loading?
At the aggregate level for particularly the residential class, yes. That is all circuits considered together.
Okay, and all circuits are considered as an average, is that correct?
That's correct.
And could you explain briefly why they are not done on an individual circuit level?
Well, first of all, the data is probably not there. But more importantly, if you had numerous circuits, each with their own rate, the rate schedule would be quite confusing and violate other rate-making objectives, including simplicity for customers and potentially others as well.
Thank you. And so would having the data on individual circuits as opposed to having the data on the circuits that provide residential customer classes as a whole change the way that the distribution costs are allocated?
Yes, it would.
Okay.
It would to those individual circuits and the customers on them. As an aggregate matter, the average residential class tariff would remain the same because, you know, the way it's currently done is it is an average over all of those circuits.
Okay. Thank you. That concludes my follow-up questions.
Questions from the commission? Thank you. You're excused.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This brings us to Mr. Michael Rossetti, I believe. And
Commissioner Clark?
Yes.
As it's just past 11, I'd like to inquire when you were thinking of breaking for lunch and whether we may be able to hear from Mr. Gilliam before we break for lunch.
I think that's a good suggestion. If there's no objection, let's do that. Mr. Rossetti, you
perfectly fine with me, thank you.
Oh, all right.
So should we call him now?
That's great.
All right. Utah Clean Energy will call Mr. Rick Gilliam. He hasn't been sworn.
Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Please be seated, Mr. Gilliam.
Mr. Gilliam, would you please state your name, position, and business address for the record?
My name is Rick Gilliam. I am the Program Director of DG Regulatory Policy for the Vote Solar Initiative. My business address is 590 Redstone Drive in Broomfield, Colorado.
Did you file direct rebuttal and surrebuttal testimony in the cost of service phase in this proceeding?
Yes, I did.
If I asked you the same questions as outlined in your testimony today, would your answers be the same?
They would.
Oops. I would now move the admission of Mr. Rick Gilliam's direct rebuttal and surrebuttal testimony to the record.
Any objections? They're received. The directs in evidence currently in the rebuttal and surrebuttal are now received. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gilliam, do you have a summary of your testimony that you would like to present?
Yes, I do.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Commissioners, first I'd like to say thank you for accommodating my schedule today. I truly appreciate that. This is a fairly complex case, although now we're down to one single issue, and I'd like to really try and take a step back and focus on what the critical elements are of that issue, because we've at various times gotten into a lot of minutia about this this net metering issue. This issue is worth about $100,000, which is pretty small, and as we've heard, it is a lot to individual customers, but it's fairly small in the grand scheme of things. The issue really comes down to one key point: whether or not the Commission should evaluate the costs and benefits of net metering in more depth than is currently available in evidence in this proceeding. But this issue is also about the rights of individual customers, that is, the right to self-determination. We believe that electricity customers, that retail customers and residential customers in particular, have the right to use as much or as little electricity as they so choose. That says nothing about the rate structures, but that is a choice that the customers may make. They may choose to put in efficient refrigerators or to buy an electric vehicle. They may choose to put on a solar system, or they may choose to change appliances from gas to electricity for a variety of reasons, but that's their personal choice. The net metering issue almost brings a visceral reaction from some, and I'd like to explore what net metering is just a little bit. And to do that, I want to refer to a couple of things that are Utah-based. First of all, the statute. In the statute, net metering is defined as measuring the amount of net electricity for the applicable billing period. Net electricity is the difference, as measured at the meter owned by the electrical corporation, between the amount of electricity that the utility supplies to the customer participating in the program and the amount of customer-generated electricity delivered to. So that's where the netting occurs, at the meter. To the extent that there is no export of electricity, there is no net metering. There is nothing to net. In Ms. Stewart's testimony, in this proceeding, in her direct testimony, she narrows that down as well in her concerns about the cost shift issue of net metering. And she says it this way: the net metering customer is not contributing to fixed cost recovery through the usage that the customer's excess generation is credited against. And we've had a lot of discussion about that excess generation. In support of the charge, a number of parties in this proceeding have talked about cost causation. And I would have to say that our view is that there has been no evidentiary showing that there are any incremental costs associated with net metering that are being passed on to other customers. And in fact, as we just heard with the last witness's testimony, cost causation is really tied to cost allocation, or perhaps I should say that in reverse. Cost allocation is a result of the company's view of, or the commission's view of, how those costs are incurred. And I'll talk about the individual allocations in a minute. But Rocky Mountain Power incurs the cost to provide service to customers, as we heard yesterday, for a homogeneous neighborhood where all the houses are pretty much the same. The costs are pretty much the same as well. But having said that, the amount of contribution by each of the residences in that neighborhood varies and can vary substantially, as we can see in some of the exhibits that have been presented in this proceeding. Now, some would have us believe that cost recovery based on 511 kilowatt hours of grid electricity, which is the actual amount per month that net metering customers continue to take from Rocky Mountain Power, is somehow different than the cost recovery that occurs when another customer that doesn't have a net metering system also uses or consumes on average 500 kilowatt hours per month. Bottom line is they are the same. 511 kilowatt hours is the same in either case. The same cost recovery occurs. So there's no evidence in the record that the former, that is the net metering customer, causes any more cost on the utility than does the customer that does not have the net metering system and consumes the same amount. I have a number of examples I think I'll pass through right now, but the issue that I want to highlight is that the calculation the company has made here and the evidence in this record is solely based on the change in net consumption, and that is not the same thing as cost causation. It is very different. Now, I mentioned I was going to talk about the allocation, and as we, again, recently heard, that cost causation is reflected in the methods of the cost assignment to customer classes. I think the exchange we just heard between the Sierra Club and Mr. Ferreira's demonstrates that to the extent there is any reduction in the load at the time of the distribution system peak by a net metered system, there will be a commensurate reduction in the allocation of costs to that customer class. And that results in a savings. Those savings are not reflected in this calculation of the charge that Rocky Mountain Power would like to implement. However, those reductions in the allocation factor will, by their nature, be reflected in the actual calculation of the allocation ratios whenever that occurs, because they are endemic to the system. That's just what happens at the time of that peak. So whether the utility includes those numbers, those savings, those benefits, as a reduction to the cost that they want to charge net metering customers, those benefits still exist and are passed on to all other residential customers. So does net metering shift costs? We've heard a lot of testimony about the revenue reduction related to net metering, and a superficial mathematical equation that assumes you start with a fixed pie, a total pie that you have to recover, will result in some shifting of costs from one group to another. Unfortunately, we don't know how much and in what direction unless we do a full-blown cost-benefit analysis. But let's talk about the pie itself. Because Rocky Mountain Power is a member of PacifiCorp, it is assigned certain costs of the utility, the large utility as a whole. Those costs are based on certain allocation factors. For example, production and transmission plant are assigned across the PacifiCorp system 75% on demands coincident with the system peak and 25% on an energy basis. Well, clearly the reduction in energy caused by a net metered system will reduce that portion of the allocator. And because the system peaks are more coincident, the broad system peaks, not the distribution system peaks, are more coincident with the generation profile of solar, you will get a better capacity value for that that allocator, and you will have an additional reduction on the demand side. So the solar system that is net metered will provide benefits on both the demand and the energy portion of the production and transmission allocator, meaning that Utah is assigned fewer costs as a result of the net metering system.
Commissioner Clark, I apologize to interrupt, and we're trying to be patient. I guess I'd simply like to note that rather than a summary of testimony, the witness appears to be doing a complete new recitation of his entire testimony, and in some regards going above and beyond what has been submitted in any of his testimony. And, of course, while it's germane to track a summary and to make cross-examination notes, when a witness is not even responding to questions but is simply allowed to speak, you know, at liberty, it certainly makes it difficult to track for cross. And so I'm just wondering if we can get some clarification as to the bounds and scope of the summary.
Ms. Hayes?
Thank you. I'm unaware of there being sort of a distinction between having a written summary and being allowed to sort of extemporize on the witness stand. I think it's appropriate that Mr. Gilliam is summarizing his testimony. I think it's reasonable to be mindful of everyone's time, but I think everything he's saying is well related to his testimony.
This practice in the commission requires judgment and balance, and just from a time perspective, we're sort of at the outside of what would typically be used for a summary. So, Mr. Gilliam, I want you to be able to continue, but I think it'd be well to reach a conclusion soon so that we can have the cross-examination proceed. Are you near the end of what you intended to?
Yes, actually, I have one more point I'd like to make, and then I'll wrap up.
Thank you.
Okay. And that's all I want to say about allocation. I just wanted to clarify the allocation issue. Finally, there's the issue of single-issue rate making. Rocky Mountain Power has asked for a charge based on distribution costs only, distribution or retail costs only, and only applied to the residential class. Most jurisdictions that I'm familiar with usually look at the comprehensive picture of a particular issue. Otherwise, you can end up in a situation of some expenses going up, and those are the ones that are only that the utility only wants the commission to look at, while others may go down. So my point is that only looking at this one narrow piece leaves out other pieces, such as commercial benefits and the transmission and generation benefits that are not fully explored in this docket. So with that, I will just summarize my summary. First of all, there is no sense of urgency. This is a very small piece of the overall puzzle here in the state of Utah. For Rocky Mountain Power, it's about 0.1% penetration, and it will take 10 years to get, well, maybe not 10, maybe 9 years, even growing at 30%, to get to the kind of penetration that we see in Colorado and Arizona today. So there's no sense of urgency. I won't repeat all the things I just said. In the interest of brevity, I'll just say that no other state that I'm aware of has enacted a charge such as this after an evidentiary hearing, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gilliam is available for cross-examination.
Mr. Moskin.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Gilliam.
Good morning.
And I will attempt to be brief and actually only touch on a few points in your testimony. To begin, why don't you start turning to page 7 in your direct testimony? And while you're going there, is it a fair statement, is it fair, and I recognize I'm paraphrasing, but that one of your main criticisms in your materials is you attack the proposed facilities charges being discriminatory because you believe that or allege that energy efficient customers that consume less are not being charged this. So the fact that net metered customers are is discriminatory. Is that a fair kind of a characterization of one of your points?
Well, the point's a little broader than that. It's not just energy efficiency customers. It's any customer that has a consumption of roughly an equivalent level is not being charged or not being subject to another charge, nor are customers that have more contribution towards fixed costs, residential customers, mm-hmm. being given a credit for that additional contribution.
Okay. So on page 7, I'm looking at line 116, you indicate that the implication of establishing fees and charges for consumers based on one specific behavior that reduces consumption are problematic and far-reaching. That's the point you're making now?
Correct.
You would agree with me, though, wouldn't you, that net metering really is not about energy consumption, is it? I mean, you'd agree with me that one net metered customer that consumes a large amount of electricity, they may have very inefficient refrigerator, they may leave the TV on all night, they may do whatever that it is that they do that consumes electricity, and the fact that they put solar panels on their rooftop does not change the amount of energy they consume. Would you agree with that point?
Well, in your example, yes, I would agree with that. But the typical net metering customer is pretty energy conscious and does net metering after doing other efficient technologies.
So is your analysis requiring the commission to have an assumption of this type of personality that you believe is a net metering customer?
No, I'm just explaining the kind of person that we typically see as net metered.
One of the points that you made near the end of your summary, I believe without joking, it was in the summary of your summary, is you said that it is dangerous to focus on just one piece of this. You didn't use the word puzzle, but just to limit the commission's focus. I'd like you to flip the page over to page 8 in your direct. And at line 134, you indicate, therefore, the commission's net metering focus should be limited to solar generation that leaves the retail customer's premises, i.e. is exported, period. Based on what you said in your summary, I assume it's fair to say you do not really intend to state that this commission should really only focus on exported energy in their analysis. Is that true?
In the analysis that we're recommending be done, which is a cost-benefit analysis in a separate process, yes, that is what we would be recommending, is that exported energy, which is the basis for net metering, as which is the issue that Ms. Stewart raises in her testimony as the concern for Rocky Mountain Power, is or should be the basis for the analysis.
But you would agree with me, would you not, that a typical net metered customer both imports and exports power across the grid? Is that correct?
The typical customer would purchase power from the utility, but would not, I wouldn't call it exporting power across the grid. As Mr. Rossetti said yesterday, it really goes into a neighbor's house or business.
But to get to that neighbor's house, it has to leave the home of the person with the panels on their roof, going on company facilities, travel down another company line, down the company line, to that other neighbor's house. Isn't that correct?
Well, when you look at what you just described, the line that gets the power from the solar customer's house to the distribution circuit is paid for without exception, or I shouldn't say without exception, is paid for by the net metering customer. It's the service drop. It's part of the customer charge.
But it's the distribution system that gets it to the neighbor, isn't it?
That's correct. I won't dispute that certainly there is some small section, maybe in rural areas it could be a bit longer section of line that does get that power to the neighbor. Right.
So when you indicated that you're not aware that the exporting actually uses these company facilities or the importing, it in fact does. Both importing power when they need power and when they export power if they have excess, both processes use company facilities, do they not?
Well, when they import power, they pay for those facilities. When they export power, the neighbor pays for those facilities.
So let's actually go to that point here. So when you say that the neighbor pays for those facilities, isn't it true that the company turns around and credits the customer back at retail rate?
That's right. That's right. So it's a net wash for the utility.
Okay. That's so when you say it's been paid for the utility, it's not collecting anything. It's a wash, right?
It's not collecting anything, but it's not costing anything either.
Well, the company has to maintain the two distribution lines that we just talked about to have that loop occur, doesn't it?
Well, and this is why the full-blown cost-benefit analysis needs to be done, because you should make those arguments in that proceeding.
We need an argument to determine, or an analysis to determine whether those systems are utilized both to import and export a kilowatt of power?
Again, they're already paid for the import. For the export, there is use of those lines, and I don't disagree. The customers should pay for that. The okay. question is whether or not the benefits of the net metered system are sufficient in total, looking at all the various pieces, to overcome, to offset those additional costs to the extent there are any identifiable.
Okay. So you would agree with me that if this commission determines that there are costs associated with net metering, including both the costs of the customer importing power from the system when it needs power and when it exports power, that those costs should be appropriately paid for by that customer in their power bill?
The export, to the extent that there are costs associated with the export, those costs are part of the overall set of costs that the utility incurs and that customers pay for. We are not saying that utility should not recover its cost. What we're saying is that the commission should look at all the benefits associated with the distribution system, the transmission system, the generation system, and whatever other factors folks would like to raise to compare to the costs and see, do the benefits offset the costs or do the costs exceed the benefits?
Okay, so you're actually getting the point that I want to make. Initially, I thought you were indicating there were no costs. Now you seem to be indicating that, yes, there are costs, but we should weigh the benefits against them to see if the benefits outweigh the costs. Is that a more correct statement?
That's what I've said all along, and what I said in my summary was that there's no incremental costs associated with the export.
So let's look at your description and understanding of this exported or generation power. If you could turn to page 5 of your direct. Actually, before we get there, one of the points that you made was in your summary is that net metered customers are similarly situated to non-net metered customers, therefore you can't treat them differently. Words to that effect. Would you agree with that statement?
Something to that effect, right.
But you would agree with me, would you not, that net metered customers, simply by being that net metered customers, they're already unique. They're already separately situated than non-net metered customers, aren't they?
Well, no more so than other customers that have similar characteristics.
Well, meaning net metered customers are like other net metered customers and non-net metered customers are like non-net metered customers?
And customers that use less than 200 kilowatt hours a month are could be a separate class, and those that use over 1,000 kilowatt hours a month could be a separate class.
But isn't it a fair distinguishing characteristic to say that by voluntarily entering into net metering, the customer knows that they are entering into a separate tariff that is shared only by that group, i.e. net metered customers? That's the way it exists today, correct?
That's the way it exists today.
That's right.
Right.
And it's not uncommon, is it, in your experience, for customers on one schedule or one tariff to be charged at different rates or in different methodologies than customers on a different schedule or under a different tariff? That's not unique, is it?
No, that's not unique.
And so already net metered customers know they're entering onto a different tariff than non-net metered customers. That's not a change. That's the way it exists today, correct?
Okay.
Okay. On page 5, you, starting at line 79, ask yourself the question to describe the solar generation that's exported by a net metered customer. This is under the larger heading of Introduction to the Characteristics of Distributed Solar Generation and Net Metering. And then you ask yourself.
I'm there.
Okay. Would you read for us, beginning at line 80, where it starts exported? And it goes, I believe, two sentences, ending at the word happened.
Exported energy tends to be incidental, short-lived, and as a matter of physics, reduces the loading on the local distribution grid by supplying locally generated energy to a neighboring retail customer. This happens instantaneously, and there is no incremental cost to the utility. Indeed, the utility has no control over the flow, is not required to redispatch it in any way, and is unaware that it has happened.
Thanks. And do you still stand by those two statements?
Yes.
So you agree with me that the energy that net metered customers contribute back onto the system is incidental and is short-lived. It happens instantaneously with the utility having no control over it, and in fact the utility is unaware that it's even happening or has happened. Is that correct?
Yes.
So wouldn't you agree with me that if a utility is required to maintain reliable power service to all of its customers, that it would be impossible to offset future generation needs on a source that, by your own admission, is incidental, short-lived, utility doesn't even know if or when it's going to happen and over which it has no control?
Well, I think what you're confusing here is that we're talking about exports with these statements. Net metering also reduces the load of the customer for the utility. So that reduction in load also has an impact on the overall class allocations for both distribution system as well as production and transmission.
Okay, let's split it into the two categories you've indicated then. The first category is exporting. So you agree that exporting by itself, it would be very difficult for the power company to be able to, with any kind of reasonable certainty, plan on that exported generation because it is, according to you, incidental, short-lived, there's no control, correct?
Well, you started out saying you want to split it into two, and for some purposes that makes sense, but for planning purposes, to understand what is coming, what the effect is on the distribution circuit and on the utility as a whole, you do need to look at the entire picture.
We'll get back to this the second half, but again, my question still stands. Would you agree that power that comes onto the utility's grid from net metered customers is incidental, short-lived, and unpredictable?
On an individual customer basis, yes.
Okay. And if all of the individuals are unpredictable and incidental and short-lived, certainly you could not state that as a whole it's predictable and long-lived, could you?
It's more predictable and probably more long-lived as well. The same way that residential customers have loads that are unpredictable because of the vagaries of when people use their microwaves and blow dryers, et cetera, you can smooth that out by aggregating together a group of customers, sure. And that's how you build your distribution system. To the same extent, you can do that with distributed solar generation as well.
So the solar customers, or the net metered customers, their export to the company, to the grid, is certainly unpredictable on an individual basis, and as a group, while you might have averages, as a whole, no one knows when there's going to be sunny days or cloudy days to plan when there's going to be those watts exported to the system. Is that correct?
Well, we could unpack that a bit. You do have an idea when there's going to be sunny days, and you do know that overall the reduction in the load by produced by the solar system is going to happen on average a certain amount per month, a certain amount per year. It may not be fully predictable. It is an intermittent resource after all, but in the aggregate, it provides pretty good assurance of how much generation will be available to you, even in a day in advance.
Okay, I guess so we don't keep going in a circle around this, let me ask this. Isn't it correct that the utility needs to plan and to be able to be sure that it's able to provide power to its customers on every day, not just on average days, on days that were the predicted amount of sun or predicted amount of temperature, but on all days? Isn't that correct?
Of course. Of course. I completely agree with that. However, we're talking about an incredibly small amount of solar right now that I suspect has very little effect on your planning. However, as you are concerned about the growth of solar, now is an appropriate time to look at what those costs will be over time, look at what the planning issues may be for you over time, and to look at what the benefits are that solar will provide to your system, to your operation, as well as to other customers.
Okay, so you make the point that right now solar is a relatively small concept on the system. So is that would you agree then that the amount of projected benefit from the solar is equally small? I mean, it doesn't have a larger benefit than detriment if it's the same size one way or the other, isn't it?
It's hard to speculate on what the total benefits will be, but it's a relatively small cost. It's a relatively small benefit. I probably agree with that.
One second, Commissioner Allen, or Clark, sorry.
Off the record. And while we're off the record, does anybody have a clue to what the feedback source is? Do we?
Mr. Gilliam's mic is off. My mic is off.
Yeah, we're all off.
Okay. We just keep hearing some feedback in the system. Yes. Thank you. So I suppose for all of us, we either live with the feedback or adjust your phones accordingly. Okay. Thanks.
No further questions.
We're on the record and
no further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Jetter.
I just have a few brief questions. You talked in your opening statement about self-determination. If, let's choose a hypothetical customer who is not a net metering customer. Let's say it's a grandmother who lives alone on a fixed income and is a low user. Does she have self-determination to choose any other source of her electricity?
Probably.
Does she have another grid that she can connect to?
No, but there are solar systems or solar companies that are, and I don't know if this is very prevalent in Utah, but certainly in other states, solar companies that are putting solar in, particularly for people like that situation that are on a fixed income and want to fix their energy costs and not have to worry about increasing electricity rates. And so put in a solar system at virtually no upfront cost and start saving money right away. Again, I don't know if that's happening here in Utah, but it's certainly happening in other states.
Okay, and if this customer wants to stay connected to an electric grid, Rocky Mountain Power is the only source of that. Is that correct?
Right. Even under the scenario I just laid out, she would still be connected to the grid.
Okay, and so if there was a, in hypothetical sense, if there was a cost shift from a net metering customer to the total residential class, that customer would not have the self-determination to choose another grid to connect to. Is that correct?
Well, regardless of whether there's a cost shift towards non-solar customers or a benefit that all other customers share in, she does not have the choice to move to another utility.
Okay. And Rocky Mountain Power, in fact, also does not have the self-determination to choose which customers within its network that it's going to supply power to.
Yeah, that's kind of my point. They have an obligation to serve.
Okay. And you mentioned that all customers, in your view, with roughly the same monthly load are the same cost to serve. Is that your testimony?
No, what I said was they provide the same recovery of fixed costs to the utility.
Okay.
And but we're talking about residential customers.
They may not cost the same to serve.
No.
On their load profile.
They may not, and it can go either way.
Okay. And would you agree that a customer with a peakier load or that's demanding more instantaneous load during shorter periods is more expensive to serve than one who has a very steady load?
Well, it's a complicated question. It really depends on when that peak occurs and if that's consistent, if it's at the same time as the system peak or if it's in the middle of the night, then there would be a much different answer. If it was at the same time as the system peak, then yeah, that would be a more expensive load to serve, certainly.
Thank you. And finally, you had addressed the issue of single item rate making. This is, in fact, a general rate case. Is that correct?
Well, the general rate case has settled. This is the one remaining issue, and it is a single issue in the sense that it's only looking at one class, the cost for one class of customers, and a very narrow definition of the cost that's being reviewed.
Okay, and so, but this particular docket was as it initiated a general rate case where the overall rates for all customers are available to be adjusted.
That's my understanding. Yeah.
And is there any rate or any component of any rate that you were prevented in this proceeding from presenting evidence on?
No.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Mr. Coleman.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Late morning. A couple of questions to follow up a little bit from Mr. Moskin. If you would turn in your direct testimony to lines 74 through maybe 78 or so.
I'm there.
There. So here you outline kind of three, I can't think of the right word, maybe species or subspecies of customers, three categories of customer. Sorry, I'm a former biologist. So,
so is my wife. Actually, it's if I can jump in, that's sure. Not exactly correct. I'm talking about three different times of day.
Okay. So
with the same customer.
Okay. So a customer can take under your discussion here three different forms. You can be as you talk about the amount of energy generated at any one time can be zero. So that would be and they would be importing energy from the system.
They'd be using energy just like before net metering.
Okay. But in that case, there's actually two different types of that status, in that you could be importing energy just like a standard customer and paying for it, or you could be importing energy and redeeming credits, correct?
Well, and I have to confess, I'm not intimately familiar with the net metering tariff sheet here. But based on the earlier conversations, my understanding is that redeeming of credits, if you will, occurs at the end of the month and not on an as-you-go basis. In other words, there's two registers on the meter, one that measures inflows and one that measures outflows. And they're not netted on an instantaneous basis. They're netted at the end of the month on a customer's bill. So it's more of an accounting entry than it is an actual redemption later on that same day or the next day.
Okay. So then, just I try and keep it brief, because much of my subject matter has been covered. Around on line 336 of your direct, you're discussing the analysis that you incorporated, or. And you called it the Utah CPR analysis. And you assert, you admit there on line 36, or 336, excuse me, that analysis did not look at any of the costs to the utility.
That's correct.
And so then you, a little bit later in your testimony, elsewhere in your testimony, you indicated that you conducted your own cost analysis to supplement that deficiency. Is that correct?
I wouldn't call it a deficiency, but yes, I did a cost analysis based on the reduction in consumption and the effects on reduction in demand charges for commercial customers.
One of your criticisms of the company's presentation and the office's presentation was that there was not a complete cost-benefit analysis, correct?
Yes.
And so under that context, the fact that the CPR analysis the cost side of the coin, but only the benefit side of the coin, would be a deficiency, which is why I use the word.
Yes, if I had presented it that way, although, and maybe I didn't write this very artfully, but my intention here was to show an example of another study that was done on the benefits, because it's really the benefits side of the equation for residential and the cost and benefit side for the commercial customers that was missing from the record in this proceeding at the time. So, and as you'll see at the end, I do recommend that a separate, full, comprehensive cost-benefit study be performed with all stakeholders being involved. So I'm not suggesting that the commission just accept what I've done here as the gospel truth and move forward from there and reject the charge on that basis. But I am showing that there are clear benefits that other studies have found that need to be taken into consideration before implementation of any kind of net metering charge.
So turning to line 381 of your direct testimony, the very last word on that line, and then rolling over through 383, your testimony reads, quote, "The inescapable conclusion is that benefits are likely to outweigh the costs, and no justification exists for imposition of a new fee at this time," period, end quote. So your testimony is that you believe, without performing the cost-benefit analysis that you've identified should be done, that you've come to the inescapable foregone conclusion, that the benefits are going to be greater than the costs.
Yes, based on this study for the purposes of this proceeding. But following this proceeding, we are recommending that the commission undertake a separate, I don't know if it would be a formal docket or an informal workshop process, but a process to evaluate the costs and benefits of net metering comprehensively across all customer classes. Maybe to put a finer point on it, I'm using that conclusion to say that the net metering charge proposed by Rocky Mountain Power should be rejected in this proceeding.
I understand that to be your testimony. I have no further questions.
Mr. Rossetti.
Oh. I wasn't expecting you to be able to ask a question, so I will. that's okay. Is it difficult? Is it difficult for the residential class of consumer to do an analysis in the aggregate of their system usage patterns?
Calls for speculation.
I didn't hear that.
I'm sorry. I was objecting to the question in that he's asking the witness to speculate about whether residential customers can or can't figure these things out.
Well, you were asking earlier about aggregate net metering, or no, individual net metering, and then you cast that against aggregate net metering. I'm just trying to ask about whether the same is true for residential customers in toto.
I still may maintain my objection.
Would you restate your question, please, Mr. Rossetti?
I'm trying to determine if Mr. Gilliam has an opinion on how difficult it is to do a system usage analysis, as Mr. Moskin was talking about earlier, for residential customers, because Mr. Moskin compared net metering customers to residential customers. And I was wondering in terms of this analysis and whether we could project the impact of net metering customers.
Do you have an opinion on that, Mr. Gilliam?
The one clarification I would ask is if you're asking me for my opinion on whether an individual customer could evaluate their own or the company, class,
for example,
the class as a whole,
whether anybody, specifically the company, since they have the information, can do that kind of analysis and project peak loads, etc.
Yes, I do have an opinion.
Answer the question, please.
Yes, the company has the information and the data to do that type of analysis.
And are they able to account, or companies similar to them, I don't want to just pick on them, are they able to account for cloud cover or sudden torrential rains like we had yesterday?
Yes, they are. In the kind of cost-benefit study we're talking about, however, for on both the cost side, on the customer side, as well as on the solar generation side, you take unusual events out. In other words, you would sort of normalize to normal conditions on both sides.
So it's averaged out?
Yes.
Is it any more difficult to do that for net metering customers?
Not at all.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Mr. Culley or Mr. Plank?
We have no questions of this witness, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Roberts?
I have one question. Mr. Gilliam, is there a certain, is responsive to the question that the office asked you about the benefits analysis presented in the CPR study and then the cost analysis that you developed. Would you agree that there's a certain difficulty created in trying to compare costs and benefits when those estimates of costs and benefits have been developed by different adversarial parties based on different data and using different assumptions?
Before the witness answers, could I guess just lodge the same objection raised earlier, which is having aligned parties rehabilitate witnesses through friendly cross-examination? And just, you know, raising the general commission rule against that.
Mm-hmm. I think the answer is obvious to all of us who have been here, but I'm going to allow you to answer this one question from Ms. Roberts.
Okay. And yes, the obvious answer is yes. And the follow-on recommendation, of course, would be that to the extent you go forward with a separate evaluation of costs and benefits, it's important that there be much transparency and data availability to do that analysis by all stakeholders.
Thank you. Ms. Hayes.
I have no further questions.
Commissioner LaVar.
When Mr. Jetter was cross-examining you, he proposed a hypothetical customer to you with respect to your comments earlier about self-determination. I presume your response to Mr. Jetter's question presumed the hypothetical customer to be a homeowner and not a tenant. Is that accurate?
Yes, I did.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman Allen? Or? Okay. Mr. Gilliam, you're excused.
Thank you. Thank you for your indulgence again.
Thank you. Let's be off the record.
The company's fine with just taking until 1 o'clock.
Does that work for everyone else?
We're fine with that, too, Commissioner Clark.
Okay, thank you. Okay. On the record, we'll be in recess till 1 o'clock. Thank you very much.